was one of the singers in the mass meetings.
Rutha Harris was a 21-year-old African-American student at Florida University. While she was home in Albany, she got involved in the movement there and became one of a celebrated group of protest singers, the SNCC Freedom Singers. In all parts of the civil rights movement, music and religion were powerful tools to mobilize protesters.
Music of those meetings, or music of the civil rights movement, without music, that wouldn't have been a movement. With music, it soothes your soul, and there were songs that we would sing. Say, for instance, if we were going to go on a march that particular night, we would sing songs to get you ready for the march, like, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around,
ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land."
Music was so crucial. It was the inspiration. People came to mass meetings not so much for discussion of strategy planning as to be uplifted and supported to get the bravery to go forth and do what they had to do. And that, a lot of that binding, like glue, that went on between all the people in the movement in that time happened through music.
Well, we sang a song, it was like going to church. It was like being in church. It was like meditating. It was like praying, you know. So we were in a certain groove when we began to sing. So you could sing anywhere. You can sing in jail. You can sing on a march. You can sing in your meetings that we have, or our study sessions. We always sang. We always prayed. It was the fact that we were brought up this way. It was a natural thing for us.
If you were going to go on a march knowing that you're going to maybe be hit or dragged or spat on, for me, there is a song that I use, and it's "Just a Closer Walk with Thee." Just a closer walk with thee, granny Jesus, if you please. Daily walking close to thee, let it be.
Dear, that was my song. And every time I would go on a march, I'd have that in my mind.
And the music was really an important part. Anybody that you talk to in the movement will verify that. When I was talking about the beloved community and the sense of unity of purpose and unity of spirit and values and respect for each other, that was just sort of gelled in singing together. And man, when you would get in there, Albany in particular, when you would get in there and you would hear the singing to the rafters, it was absolutely one of the ways that you could lift your spirits and get inspired. You know, so it's very meaningful.
And we all know the music totally deep into our bones, you know, and remember the words and the melody. I mean, it's for me, there's no other music that I'm as connected to as to that music. But it was just so important. I since then, I have participated in numbers of movements in one way or another, whether it's peace movements or the women's movement, whatever, you know, and there are attempts at music. The labor movement had some music. And the old folk singers and Pete Seeger and those folks, they had some music. But, you know, the modern day movements don't have music anywhere approaching like what was in the movement.
Listening to Deep in Our Hearts. Penny Patch worked in Southwest Georgia for a year and a half. In addition to working in Albany, she served as a field worker in Terrell and Sumner counties. In the fall of 1963, she went north to visit her family and take a break. The civil rights movement was changing direction. Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Over 200,000 people attended.
The one day on the red hills of Georgia. Sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners.
Other changes were happening all over the country. Congress voted to give women equal pay for equal work. And in November 1963,
Texas
President
Governor
Kennedy
John
was assassinated.
Connelly were shot from ambush today in Dallas, Texas. And it is not known whether either
died
Mr.
at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Joan left the South for a few months in 63. As her brother said years later, she'd been written out of the family. Her family had disowned her for her participation in the Freedom Ride. She was totally on her own, trying to make a living. She went to Boston to work. She did some speaking and fundraising for SNCC, but felt out of place in the cosmopolitan Boston movement scene. In January 1964, Connie Curry was 27. SNCC had moved off college campuses and into communities, so her involvement as part of the National Student Association was waning. She also felt it was time for a change. She was recruited by the American Friends Service Committee as a Southern field representative to work with the white community in Mississippi for peaceful school desegregation. Elaine DeLotte was a junior at Radcliffe. For her, going to Mississippi was not a political act. Over Christmas break, she and her boyfriend, a Harvard student, were arrested for sharing a bed, a crime in the state of Massachusetts. The colleges were notified, and Elaine was ordered to leave campus immediately.
In the meantime, we went to go to our trial, and because Harvard is in collusion with the local police, there was this charade where they managed to get the whole thing taken to judges' chambers so that the newspaper people wouldn't get wind of what was going on. In judges' chambers, it was as if I didn't exist. The questions were, well, what does Harvard think of this? They asked the Harvard dean, what does Harvard think? And then they asked the Radcliffe dean, well, what does Radcliffe think of this? And then they asked Ricky, but they never asked me what I thought.
Elaine was readmitted to Radcliffe. She finished spring quarter, and some friends who were graduate students were going to teach for the summer at all-black Tougaloo College in Mississippi so the faculty there could go north to get advanced degrees. They invited Elaine to come along.
I was probably there for about a month, and someone from Jackson heard that I knew something about sociology, and I had worked with Dr. Pettigrew at Harvard, who had done a study of housing projects and discrimination. So they asked me if I would design a questionnaire that could be used in the summer project. I was not finished by the time it was time to go to the orientation for the summer project in Ohio. So they said, well, why don't you come with us and work on it? So I got on the bus and went off to the orientation for the Freedom Summer in Oxford, and then was caught up in that energy and commitment and the ideas. And then I began to understand something about where I had landed and was really swept up.
This was the beginning of Freedom Summer. A corps of young civil rights workers had been working in Mississippi for several years, laying the groundwork to bring hundreds of students from out of state into Mississippi, a state that had resisted all attempts to register African Americans to vote. 1964 was a presidential election year, and SNCC organized volunteers to do a number of tasks: expand black voter registration in the state, established freedom schools to teach math, reading, and black history to black children, and establish a Freedom Democratic Party that would challenge the whites-only Mississippi Democratic Party. Penny Patch returned to SNCC in January 1964 and was working in the Jackson office helping to organize the Freedom Summer Project.
I had been in Oxford, Ohio at one of the orientation sessions, and it was almost immediately upon our return that we got word that James Chaney and Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman were missing.
James Chaney and Mickey Schwerner were longtime Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, workers. Andrew Goodman was a volunteer who had arrived in the state only a day before he disappeared. Their bodies were not found until August.
I was actually on the Watts line part of the time when the communication was going back and forth.
And so I was one of a number of people who were in the office who answered telephones, made phone calls, coordinated search efforts, talked to FBI, talked to reporters. I mean, it was just endless for weeks there. It was horrible. By Tuesday, it was clear they were dead.
And the seriousness of that event, I mean, deepened the resolve of everyone. And coming back to Mississippi after that, with that knowledge, it was very somber. And I had become really part of that group.
In Washington, the Civil Rights Act, which had been introduced by President Kennedy the summer before, was being filibustered. Opponents held the floor to talk it to death for 75 days. Finally, under the leadership of Senator Hubert Humphrey and Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, enough Republicans were convinced to support it. It was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson hours after it passed on July 2, 1964. That fall, Elaine dropped out of Radcliffe and headed back to Mississippi.
Darling, you sent me. I know you sent me.
Darling, Sam Cooke. Every time I hear Sam Cooke, I'm back in Mississippi. There were many kinds of initiatives. One, of course, was voter registration. One was direct action in picketing in different situations. Freedom Schools was an enormous effort, many different kinds of community efforts. There was another effort that was around economics, about what we could access through the federal government that might be a building block for long-term action. And one of these was co-ops, farm co-ops. And that's one that I eventually became the most involved with, and particularly in a co-op in Batesville in Mississippi.
In the fall, that's when I moved to work in Panola County, Mississippi. I was based in a small town called Batesville, which was the county seat, I assume. And there I worked in the office. I canvassed for voter registration, canvassed and organized people for an election with something called the Freedom Vote, helped to organize an okra cooperative. And this is where I met Elaine.
Okra farmers in Batesville wanted to form a co-op to get a better price for their crop. The black farmers there contacted the SNCC office in Jackson to send an organizer. It was the fall of 64, and most of the Freedom Summer volunteers had returned to college.
So when I got there, they were pretty much shocked. I was always introduced at these meetings, this reverend who was an okra farmer, who was one of the mainstays of this action, would introduce me as, well, we've been calling down to Jackson and asking them to send us somebody to help us, and but they're all doing other stuff. So in the meantime, they sent us this white girl. And then I'd get up, and there I was, this white girl. And then we'd just get into it. They were incredibly generous and wonderful and accepting of me, given the fact that I was 21 and knew nothing about farming and really was a stranger in every way that was imaginable.
I was living at Mr. and Mrs. Miles's house, Robert and Mona Miles, in Batesville, Mississippi.
When I was in Batesville, I stayed in the farmhouse of Mr. and Mrs. Miles. Incredibly wonderful people. Incredibly wonderful people.
Founding members of the Panola County movement, part of the absolute backbone of the Black movement in that particular little corner of Mississippi.
The house had been shot into several times. They had moved their family into the back.
Very dangerous for the Miles family and for other people like them. Their house was firebombed. Their house was shot into any number of times, and I was present for a couple of those times.
I slept in the front bedroom in a bed, and the headboard had bullet holes in it.
It was quite dangerous.
They were on the floor in the back room, and we were in the front room, right by the road.
And during my year there, there were shootings.
The neighbors guarded the house, and there was somebody on the roof with shotguns.
People were beaten all the time. People were arrested all the time.
You know, I don't know whether the house was shot into when I was there or not.
My own personal experiences sitting in the Miles's house and, you know, having gunshots come through the window and missing us all by a hair, actually, that time.
I don't have any memory of it.
So there is a lot I don't remember of what happened.
So you could say it's post-traumatic stress, or maybe it didn't happen. I don't know. We were all so young. You felt you were responsible for what was happening to people and had no way to make it better. In retrospect, we can say the summer of 64 was a critical watershed, but it certainly didn't feel like that. It just felt like force and violence were just coming down like hammers. So many sharecroppers were displaced. We had nothing to offer them. We knew firsthand of people whose lives, because they had taken a political stand, their lives, their livelihoods, they lost everything and they were in physical jeopardy. And we had nothing to give them. It felt really bad.
Pardon me, all you people who enjoy your peace of mind. You say everybody's equal, everybody is doing fine. You should have been down in Mississippi in the summer of 64. If you were down in Mississippi, you wouldn't say that anymore. Pardon me, Mr. Backlash.
Shared experiences like these had created a tight bond between SNCC workers. But SNCC had grown from having a staff of about 25 in 1962 to having a staff of 200 by 1964. The shared leadership that had worked so well for them in the early years wasn't working with a staff this size. It was difficult to find consensus with 200 members.
When we were a very few white people, when we were 5 white people and 24 black people, it's not a problem to be white in that group of people. I mean, never did white people run SNCC. There was never even any danger of white people running SNCC, but it all became unmanageable, and people were exhausted and in despair.
The context of the movement was a context in which people created new roles for themselves because of the ability to create new roles. Everybody was free to operate at the highest level that they could operate. And one of the things that it created was new roles for women. We also had the incredible role model of strong black women who were leaders in the movement, who spoke their mind. in a way that was nothing like anything I'd ever seen in the white community.
It was in Greenwood, Mississippi,
and the white women got together with the black women.
Andrew Young is the former ambassador to the UN. In the 1960s, he worked for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
And it was by and large because women were doing all the most dangerous things. Women were going around knocking on doors, registering voters. The men tended to ride in the cars and have the two-way radios. Men were always the spokesman, and women were always doing all the work. Also, there was a kind of a sexual thing.
There were lots of interracial relationships within SNCC, and most particularly in the early years. There was a lot of sex. We were very young. We were in wartime. That's what you would expect. And all of the relationships were not interracial, but certainly many of them were. There was certainly the element of breaking the old taboo of interracial sex.
A lot of ideas were fermenting. A SNCC meeting was called and position papers were called for.
A position paper was just a way of saying, what are the issues that you're thinking about and where do you stand on them? A group of us had been talking about these issues and we decided to put our concerns in a position paper called the Position of Women in the Movement.
This position paper that was presented at SNCC's Where Do We Go Now meeting at Waveland, Mississippi, is now viewed by historians as one of the early documents of the budding feminist movement. It expressed the feelings of some, but not all, of the women in the movement.
What I think it was an expression of the emotion of what it felt like to be doing the same work, the same creative, dangerous work as men, and to still be treated in the way that polite society treated women. I think there's another undercurrent that has to do with the undercurrent of sexual tensions. There was a time in the beginning, say the early parts of the movement, where black-white relationships were not seen as anything to be concerned about. They were seen as maybe breaking taboos, certainly not something to be sanctioned. But as the movement began to mature, the issue of black men with white women became a more politically charged issue, and it was seen as a rejection of black women and a rejection of black culture. Black men who had been close to white women, had white girlfriends, began to distance themselves more from these women publicly, if not privately, sometimes only publicly.
Young people in the freedom movement were questioning racism, but they also began to question themselves and the ways that they related to each other. By 1965, SNCC and the freedom movement changed direction again. The beginnings of black power were being felt. And for white women and men who were deeply involved in the movement, it became very confusing and painful.
That was the year when you could go to a SNCC conference and find out that, well, there were social events going on that no white people were invited to. It wasn't that you weren't invited to come and discuss policy. It was that our social lives were separating. And that had not been the case early on in the least. And so for me, I felt I was losing my family and my always tenuous ability to maintain stamina, be able to work hard, to not be terrified all the time, because I got more and more afraid as the years went on.
By 1965, Penny Patch and Elaine DeLotte moved on with their lives. Connie Curry and Joan Browning stayed involved in human relations and poverty programs for a number of years. Today, Connie lives in Atlanta, where she's writing her fourth book about grassroots activists in the civil rights movement. Joan Browning now lives in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, where she's a freelance writer and lecturer and remains deeply involved in issues of social and especially racial justice. Penny Patch is a nurse midwife in northern Vermont. She has long been active in maternal child health. Elaine DeLotte Baker lives in Denver, where she directs workforce initiatives for the Community College of Denver. They've all remained activists in some way, shape, or form.
I do what I do now because of what I did then. I can never be totally depressed because I saw a time when people rose up and really changed a very evil thing. And we didn't change it far enough, but we changed a very evil thing. And so I always will believe in the power of people.
I learned I had more stamina than I thought. I learned that I was braver than I thought. I learned that I was more intelligent than I thought, actually, because I got to stretch myself in the movement and do things that would never have been available to a white woman of my class in that time. And I acquired a passion for freedom and justice and those kinds of things that have carried me a long way. I use every little bit of what I learned in the movement.
Your heart beats faster and you run across the room when you see another SNCC person, you know, low after all these years, because that bond is always there.
The freedom of struggle was the flame and all else was shadow. In some ways, Mississippi was a sacrament. It was an experience of communion and a grace that was so powerful that the memory of that has sustained me as I've moved along in my life and my work.
Deep in Our Hearts is a production of Trillium Media. The writer and producer is Sandra Slight Brennan. I'm Jan Soule. The historical consultants were Dr. Charles Hardy, Dr. Barbara Ransby, and Dr. Alonzo Hamby. Special thanks to Keith Newman, Jim Wachtel, and Mark Leff. Additional assistance comes from the University of Georgia Press. The stories of Joan, Elaine, Connie, Penny, and five other women are told in their book, Deep in Our Hearts. This production was made possible in part by a grant from the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. For more information on this documentary, pictures, and information on how to get a copy of the book, go to our website, www.trilliummedia.org.